Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to episode 13 on June 5th, 2014. Your hosts are me, Carolyn Yeager.
And me, Ray Goodwin.
And how are you tonight, Ray?
I'm doing well. I'm anxious for this, for the folks to hear this material this evening.
Yeah, I know how much you like it. It's just great stuff. And tonight's show, I want to announce to people right now, we'll probably not go over 1 hour, or except for maybe just a little bit, just to finish up what we're doing. Because Raymond has got to go on a long drive and do a favor for someone. So we don't want to go over, and we don't need to go over if we don't have to, if we don't want to, I mean. So it's just so that the people listening, you people listening, know what to expect. So Raymond, since that's the case, let's get started, and you can tell us what the date is and the topics and so on.
Okay, just a personal word about the material that we hope to cover this evening. This is, every week is a powerful lesson to me, but this one was so much affirmation and vindication, if you will, of ideas and beliefs and all that I've had for many a year, and I hope the audience appreciates that this evening. We're going to start here with the 2nd of November, 1941, evening, and the night of the 2nd and 3rd of November. In 100 years, our language will be the language of Europe. The countries east, north, and west will learn German to communicate with us. A condition for that is that the so-called Gothic characters should definitely give place to what we used to call Latin characters and now call the normal ones. We can see how right we were to make that decision last autumn. For a man who wanted to learn Russian, and we shan't make the mistake of doing that, it was already a terrible complication to adapt himself to an alphabet different from ours. I don't believe, by the way, that we're sacrificing any treasure of our patrimony in abandoning Gothic characters. The Nordic runes were written in what were more like Greek characters. Why should these Baroque embellishments be a necessary part of the German genius? In old times, Europe was confined to the southern part of the Greek peninsula. Then, Europe became confused with the borders of the Roman Empire. If Russia goes under in this war, Europe will stretch eastwards to the limits of Germanic colonization. In the eastern territories, I shall replace the Slav geographical titles by German names. The Crimea, for example, might be called Gottenland. Here and there one meets amongst the Arabs men with fair hair and blue eyes. They're the descendants of the Vandals who occupied North Africa. The same phenomenon in Castile and Croatia. The blood doesn't disappear. We need titles that will establish our rights back over 2,000 years. I'd like to remind those of us who speak of the desolate eastern territories that, in the eyes of the ancient Romans, all northern Europe offered a spectacle of desolation. Yet Germany has become a smiling country. In the same way, the Ukraine will become beautiful when we've been at work there. We owe the present fertility of our soil to the deforestation of Italy. If it weren't for that, the warm winds of the south would not reach as far as here. 2,000 years ago, Italy was still wooded, and one can imagine how our untilled countries must have looked. The Roman Empire and the Empire of the Incas, like all great empires, started by being networks of roads. Today, the road is taking place of the railway. The road is winning. The speed with which the Roman legions moved is truly surprising. The roads drive straight forward across mountains and hills. The troops certainly found perfectly prepared camps at their staging areas. The camp at Salzburg gives one an idea. I've seen the exhibition of Augustan Rome. It's a very interesting thing. The Roman Empire never had its like. To have succeeded in completely ruling the world, and no empire has spread its civilization as Rome did. The world has ceased to be interesting since men began to fly. Until then, there were white patches on the map. The mystery has vanished. It's all over. Tomorrow, the North Pole will be a crossroads, and Tibet has already been flown over.
Well, that's the end of that section. He really touches on a lot of things, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a few things I'd like to comment on. How about you?
Sure. Yeah, go right ahead.
You know, again, he's not speaking well of the Russians. He said, we shan't make the mistake of teaching people Russian. They're mm-hmm. He's seeing Russia as declining, mm-hmm. and in his plans, and so therefore we're not going to bother about that. And also this thing about the Gothic characters in books, boy, is that hard to read. I have an old copy of Mein Kampf that was given to me. It's in German, which I can't really read it, but it's from the 1930s. And it's in these Gothic characters, but you can't. Have you ever seen anything like that, Ray?
You know, I'm not sure if I have or not.
I mean, it looks like the regular alphabet, but they're in the Gothic style of the font is like mm-hmm. in the Gothic, little bit Gothic style, and it's just so ridiculous when you're just used to reading like Times Roman or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you try to read that. So I would think that they used to do that. They had lots of stuff like that in Germany. I guess they thought it was made it more German, or that was their distinctive look. But I think he's right, showing once again, modernizing things. He said we were right to make that decision last mm-hmm. autumn. So they mm-hmm. just made it like in 1940, not to do that anymore.
Right.
Seems like a good idea to me. And he says, I shall replace the Slav geographical titles by German names in the Eastern territories. Well, that's always been very controversial. But whoever's in control puts the names in their language. And, mm-hmm. of course, now they're all in the language of the, whether it's Polish or Russian or Ukrainian or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Germans moved into those areas, they changed for themselves. They changed it to the German names. And mm-hmm. we know we have those two different names for a lot of places now. But the official name is, say, the Slavic name. But they were doing that. And mm-hmm. But everybody does that. I like the German names myself better, but mm-hmm. that's the way it goes. And then he says that even going way back, a lot of people are descendants of Aryan people, or and he says, that you still see that. Well, we all know that. You still see signs of that, blonde hair, blue eyes, and people who, Arab people and so on here and there, saying that the blood doesn't disappear that fast. And he's pointing out that I think this is more like current National Socialist wartime thinking, saying that we speak of some of us speak of the desolate Eastern territories, going into the mm-hmm. East and thinking it looks desolate there. And he says I'd like to remind those people mm-hmm. or those of us who say that in the eyes of the ancient Romans, all Northern Europe offered the same spectacle. And then he goes on saying that when Italy was so wooded, he said, and he could imagine how the untilled countries of the north would have looked to them. In other words, they would look pretty wild, pretty
mm-hmm.
desolate.
Mm-hmm.
So things can be changed, and he's saying, well, we're really going to change Ukraine. It's going to be a great place after we've done some work there. So he was. Again, as we've talked about before, he's intending not to kick the people out, but to make it the German ways and manners and so on, to make it into mm-hmm. a much better place. These are things that are still controversial to people. All right, well then on November 3rd, Ray, the timeline tells us that the Germans take Kursk, K-U-R-S-K.
Mm-hmm.
That was a major battle, but that was on November 3rd, and you're going to read November 5th.
Right. 5th November, 1941, midday. Special guests, Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler, SS Staff Blaschke, and Dr. Richter.
Yeah, and that's Standartenfuhrer Blaschke, And I looked him up, and I couldn't hardly find anything on him.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, before I start reading here, where Hitler discusses the penal system, and this really hit home to born, bred, all my life Texan, because of the way we view crime, criminals, and punishment down here. I mean, it's exactly in line with the line of thinking that I was brought up around and that characterized our state. So let's share this.
Well, and speaking of our state, Texas, I don't have any opportunity to talk about this anywhere, but I read just recently that the Texas Republican Party does not accept, has a plank in there against homosexuality, and somebody was trying to run or do something, and they wouldn't allow it, and then there was a little controversy about that. But that's pretty good. They're far from that great, the Texas Republican Party, but they do stand for that, stand up for that, whereas many, many Republican, state Republican parties, I'm sure, do not.
That's correct.
Yeah. Good for Texas.
There you go. Our penal system has the result only of preserving criminals. In normal times, there's no danger in that, but when the social edifice is in peril by reason of a war or a famine, it may lead to unimaginable catastrophes. The great mass of the people is, on the whole, a passive element. On the one hand, the idealists represent the positive force. The criminals, on the other hand, represent the negative element. If I tolerated the preservation of criminals at a time when the best of us are being killed at the front, I should destroy the balance of forces to the detriment of the nation's healthy element. That would be the triumph of the rabble. If a country suffers reverses, it runs the risk that a handful of criminals, thus kept under shelter, may cheat the combatants of the fruits of their sacrifice. It's what we experienced in 1918. The only remedy for that situation is to impose the death penalty without hesitation upon criminals of this type. In Vienna before the war, more than 8,000 men used to camp on the edge of the canals, a kind of rats that come rampaging out of their holes as soon as there are rumbles of a revolution. Vienna still possesses gutter rats such as aren't found anywhere else. The danger is to give these dregs an opportunity to get together. No magistrate, priest, or politician can change an inveterate criminal into a useful citizen. Sometimes one can redeem a criminal, but only in exceptional cases. The criminal is very willing, of course, to play the game of the worthy types who work to save delinquents, for he sees in it a possibility of saving his own neck. Afterwards, he splits his sides at their expense with his confederates. Our whole penal system is a mess. Young delinquents belonging to respectable families shouldn't be exposed to living communally with creatures who are utterly rotten. It's already an improvement that in the prisons, young people are divided into groups. In any case, I'm a believer in the restoration of corporal punishment to replace imprisonment in certain cases. Like that, young delinquents would not risk being corrupted by contact with hardened criminals. A good hiding does no harm to a young man of 17, and often it would be enough. I've had the luck in the course of my life to have had a great variety of experiences and to study all the problems in real life. For example, it was in Landsberg, Gaul, that I was able to check the correctness of these ideas. A young man from Lower Bavaria who would rather have cut off his hand than stolen had had fruitful relations with a girl and had advised her to go to an abortionist. For that, he was given a sentence of 8 months. Of course, some punishment was necessary, but if he'd been given a sound licking and then let go, he'd have had his lesson. He was a nice boy. He used to tell us that for his family, it was a disgrace they could never outlive to have a son in prison. We often used to comfort him, and as a result, he wrote to us to thank us for what we'd done for him, to tell us that he'd never forget it, and to promise us that he'd never again commit the slightest evil deed. He used to end by saying that he'd only one wish, to enter the party. Signed, Heil Hitler. The letter was intercepted by the prison censorship and gave rise to a minute and niggling inquiry. But there were also real bad lots there. Each of them took up at least half of an advocate's time. There were the hibernators, the annual visitors, whom the guards used to see return with a certain pleasure, just as they themselves showed a certain satisfaction at seeing their old selves again. I also remember certain letters from prisoners to respectable people, letters that would wring your heart. Now, I realize what happens when you stop doing what religion teaches, followed by a reference to such and such, a wonderful sermon by the prison chaplain. My men once attended at a sermon. The man of God spoke of fulfilling one's conjugal duties with tremolos in his voice.
You know, that he's reading there, he says, letters that would wring your heart. I just want to say here, that says so much about him. He's talking to his close people here. He doesn't need to make an impression on anybody. He's not being hypocritical, but it shows that it rings his heart, you know, when he sees things happen to young people or any people like this. He has so much heart. Of course, he's, you know, portrayed as not, but that doesn't mean that he's softy. But he's soft when it's good to be so. And then that's a quote from one of these letters that would ring your heart, where he says, now I realize what happens when you stop doing what religion teaches. That's an example of what these people would write, that they were really brought around to following the good way, the righteous way, and so on.
That's an interesting and a viable take on it. It's funny, though, in my perspective, Carolyn, was that these prisoners are writing letters to respectable people, and these letters that would wring your heart, because he knows the insincerity of a lot of these prisoners when they say, now I realize what happens when you stop doing what religion teaches, and all those criminals are doing is trying to sway soft-hearted folks on the outside. And that's kind of what it seemed to me.
He does mention that somewhere, I think. So I guess it could depend on that.
Right.
Maybe he's being a little bit ironic here.
Yeah.
That's how you see it. Okay.
Satirical,
Okay.
Whenever there's a question of granting certain prisoners a remission of their penalty, all sorts of things are taken into account. But these displays of contrition are not the least important factor. Thanks to this play acting, many customers are let go before their term of sentence has expired.
See, there you go. That's where he is saying that. I don't think he was thought they all were, or, you know, he didn't believe any of them. But I think it's funny that he uses the word customers. That's just typical of him.
He said, I completely disagree with the procedure followed in Germany concerning matters taken to appeal. The higher court forms its judgment on the basis of the evidence given before the lower court. And this practice has many drawbacks. In the several dozen cases in which I've been involved, not once was the lower court's verdict altered. The mind of the judge of the higher court is automatically inhibited against this. In my opinion, the latter should know only the form of the accusation or complaint and should go again from the beginning through the necessary inquiries. Above all, he should be really a higher type of man. The judge's purpose is to discover the truth. As he is only a man, he can achieve this only by means of his intuition, if at all.
Well, that's great. There again, he believes in intuition. He knows how good his own intuition is, and he's used it many times already. He saved his life by it. So he's saying that if you're going to have an appeal, the judge doing the appeal should start over from the beginning on his own. He shouldn't take what has already been said by the prior judge. Isn't that what he's saying there?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. So he really wants justice. He's big on justice, and you know he never argued. He never interfered with the court system in the Third Reich. He didn't always like the judgments that they made. He thought they were too soft.
That's
but
right.
He accepted them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The now we're at November 5th, and there's fighting at Kursk. The battle is going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That was primarily a huge tank battle.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, it was. Anything more you want to say about it?
No, I'm ready to jump into this.
Okay, here we go. And you know, I'm here, Blaschke, and the same guests are still there.
Yeah.
Because it's the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are going to relate to this because I know a lot of folks that have very similar ideas on nutrition and the cause of cancer and things like this. Okay, 5th of November, 1941, evening. There is an interesting document dating from the time of Caesar, which indicates that the soldiers of that time lived on a vegetarian diet. According to the same source, it was only in times of shortage that soldiers had recourse to meat. It's known that the ancient philosophers already regarded the change from black gruel to bread as a sign of decadence. The Vikings would not have undertaken their now legendary expeditions if they'd depended on a meat diet, for they had no method of preserving meat. The fact that the smallest military unit was the section is explained by the fact that each man had a meal for grain. The purveyor of vitamins was the onion. It's probable that, in the old days, human beings lived longer than they do now. The turning point came when man replaced the raw elements in his diet by foods that he sterilizes when he eats them. The hypothesis that man ought to live longer seems to be confirmed by the disparity between his short existence as an adult on the one hand and his period of growth on the other. A dog lives on the average 8 to 10 times as long as it takes him to grow up. On that ratio, man ought to normally live from 140 to 180 years. What is certain is that in countries like Bulgaria, where people live on polenta, yogurt, and other such foods, men live to greater age than in our parts of the world. And yet, from other points of view, the peasant does not live hygienically. Have you ever seen a peasant open a window? Everything that lives on earth feeds on living materials. The fact that man subjects his foodstuffs to a physico-chemical process explains the so-called maladies of civilization. If the average term of life is at present increasing, that's because people are again finding room for a naturalistic diet. It's a revolution. That a fatty substance extracted from coal has the same value as olive oil, that I don't believe at all. It's surely better to use the synthetic fatty substances for the manufacture of soap, for example. It's not impossible that one of the causes of cancer lies in the harmfulness of cooked foods. We give our body a form of nourishment that in one way or another is debased. At present, the origin of cancer is unknown, but it's possible that the causes that provoke it find a terrain that suits them in incorrectly nourished organisms. We all breathe in the microbes that give rise to colds or tuberculosis, but we're not all enrheumed or tuberculous. Nature, in creating a being, gives it all it needs to live. If it cannot live, that's either because it's attacked from without or because its inner resistance has weakened. In the case of man, it's usually the second eventuality that has made him vulnerable. A toad is a degenerate frog. Who knows what he feeds on, certainly on things that don't agree with him. It's amazing how lacking in logic men are. The people most devoid of logic are the professors. In 2,000 years' time, when they study the origins of the inhabitants of the Ukraine, they'll claim that we emerged from the marshlands. They're incapable of seeing that originally there was nobody in the marshlands and that it was we who drove the aboriginals into the Pripet marshes in order to install ourselves instead of them in the richer lands. In Bavaria, the race is handsome in the fertile regions. On the other hand, one finds stunted beings in certain remote valleys. Nevertheless, the men are better than the women, but they content themselves with the women they have. For lack of thrushes, one eats blackbirds. The fact that the hordes of Huns passed that way can't have helped. Von Kahr must have been a descendant of those people. He was a pure Hun. The peasant has no talent for romanticism. He sticks to the realism of the soil. He behaves like the townsman who's not interested in the architecture of the shops in which he makes his purchases. Our ancestors were all peasants. There were no hunters among them. Hunters are only degenerate peasants. In old times, a man who took to hunting was looked on as a worthless creature, unless he attacked bears and wolves. In Africa, among the Maasai, lion hunters belong to a privileged caste and are honored as such. In the times when the population was too numerous, people immigrated. It wasn't necessarily whole tribes that took their departure. In Sparta, 6,000 Greeks ruled 345,000 Helots. They came as conquerors and they took everything. I changed my ideas on how to interpret our mythology the day I went for a walk in the forest where tradition invites us to lay the scene for it. In these forests, one meets only idiots, whilst all around on the plain of the Rhine, one meets the finest specimens of humanity. I realized that the Germanic conquerors had driven the aboriginals into the mountainy bush in order to settle in their place in the fertile lands. What are 2,000 years in the life of peoples? Egypt, the Greek world, Rome were dominant in turn. Today, we're renewing that tradition. The Germanic race is gaining more and more. The number of Germanics has considerably increased in the last 2,000 years, and it's undeniable that the race is getting better looking. It's enough to see the children. We ought not to expose ourselves to the mirage of the southern countries. It's the specialty of the Italians. Their climate has a softening effect on us. In the same way, southern man cannot resist our climate. 50 years ago, in the Crimea, nearly half the soil was still in German hands. Basically, the population consisted firstly of the Germanic element of Gothic origin, then of Tartars, Armenians, Jews, and Russians absolutely last. We must dig our roots into this soil. From a social point of view, the sickest communities of the New Europe are first Hungary, then Italy. In England, the masses are unaware of the state of servitude in which they live, but it's a class that ought to be ruled for its racially inferior. And England couldn't live if its ruling class were to disappear. Things would go utterly wrong for the common people. They can't even feed themselves. Where would one try to find a peasantry? In the working class? The English are engaged in the most idiotic war they could wage. If it turns out badly, anti-Semitism will break out amongst them. At present, it's dormant. It'll break out with unimaginable violence. The end of the war will see the final ruin of the Jew. The Jew is the incarnation of egoism, and their egoism goes so far that they're not even capable of risking their lives for the defense of their most vital interests. The Jew totally lacks any interest in things of the spirit. If he has pretended in Germany to have a bent for literature...
You know what? Can we talk about what we've already done and then do
the
Jew?
This is pretty divergent from what
we...
Okay.
Right.
Let's do that.
This is so interesting. Mm-hmm. I really like it. Now, I'll just say the major things I wanted to say.
Okay.
He's really got a bead on cancer. And, you know, German people, a lot of people do. In every nation, you always find at least one researcher that's discovering things that are not acceptable in the, you know, not politically correct from the general run of things. But Germany certainly has its share of people who would see medicine and healing from a politically incorrect point of view and come out and write these books and get a lot of people all excited about it. They're very, very into natural health and so on. So let's see. Well, what I really loved was when he said the townsperson who's not interested in the architecture of the shop in which he makes his purchases. This is this is the peasant who has no talent for romanticism. He behaves like the townsman who's not interested in the architecture of the shops. And which is so funny because Hitler, as a teenager already in Linz, noticed everything about the architecture of the town.
Very aware.
And boulevards and so on. He was, of course, he was interested in that. But he tried to even talk about it, and he entered something they had for designing some new building, and he came up with the design. He wasn't as good in architecture then as he became, but I guess he was pretty good. And he entered his own idea. Well, it wasn't accepted, but he thought it was better than any of the others. I mean, he was so, like you say, aware and sensitive to the way things looked. And he was telling his friend there in Linz all the time, he was criticizing things and why they needed to be rebuilt. And so from that early days when he was still a kid, he was very serious about how these things should look and had all his ideas going. He talked about it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he talks about the Germans that were in the Crimea and he wants to get back into that, I think he keeps justifying, in a sense, I don't know how much of it is just justification, the Germans taking of this and moving into these areas. Mm-hmm. And there's probably some truth in it, but I think he exaggerates it because he wants it all to become German. So he says then somewhere that we have to get a title to all these things that used to be German going back 2,000 years to show that that we have a right to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was there anything you wanted to talk about there? I think that's it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, his line there where he says, our ancestors were all peasants, he takes a very favorable view of the peasant as really the glue that was holding things together. And yes, they have a limited view and whatever. But, you know, when he says then he talks a little bit later about the British.
That's important.
And he said they can't even feed themselves. Where would one try to find a peasantry? In the working class, you know, and this remark where he says hunters are only degenerate peasants, this is another slap at the killing of animals. And, you know, like hares and foxes and deer who don't really have a chance against man's hunting with firearms.
Foxes are kind of damaging.
Mm-hmm. But
wouldn't you say the peasant to him is the man who works the land?
Yes.
The farmer. And so what he's saying
valuable.
There about England is that they don't have very many of those.
That's right. That's right. And about the hunter, you know, he says they're only degenerate peasants unless he attacked bears and wolves. So he's taking on a hunter that takes on the bears and the wolves is risking something there because those kind of animals can kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I kind of like that mention there.
Well, what he said about the British... I was very surprised at that. I can't find it right now. I'm not at it right now. But he said that the British stock was not very good.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And he said they needed these elites. And, you know, we know what the elites are like. So he said, but without their elites, they wouldn't stand up. So I've never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what British people would say about that.
I'm sure the elites would probably like it. But,
Well, that's where it kind of comes down to that he is seeing the Germans as the best. Mm-hmm. We know that, but I wonder if that colors what he's saying, and I wonder if he says a lot of this because he's not saying it on the record, and he's just talking, you know, after dinner and everything. So he just says whatever he, you know, says a lot of things the way he feels like saying them, and he kind of thinks out loud and so on, I think, in these conversations.
Yeah, I was going to say, Carolyn, that I think he's saying that out of disgust because in that sentence, when he says the English are engaged in the most idiotic war they could wage, and so, you know, he tells you previous to that they do have a ruling elite, which the common people couldn't exist without their leadership and everything, and then he's so disappointed with the English for fighting him in a war that he knows is going to destroy their empire, and so he's hacked off at them, you know. And
yeah, well, he is. But I would think he'd be he'd be angry at the elites who are responsible for it, not the average British person.
Yeah.
So I was a little surprised at that. I'm not quite reconciled to that at this point. I don't know, but if he never says anything more about it, I'll just kind of forget about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you ready to go on?
Yeah. The Jew totally lacks any interest in things of the spirit. If he has pretended in Germany to have a bent for literature and the arts, that's only out of snobbery or from a liking for speculation. He has no feeling for art and no sensibility. Except in the regions where they live in groups, the Jews are said to have reached a very high cultural level. Take Nuremberg, for example. For 400 years, that is to say until 1838, it hadn't a single Jew in its population. Result? A situation in the first rank of German cultural life. Put the Jews all together. By the end of 300 years, they'll have devoured one another. Where we have a philosopher, they have a Talmudistic pettifogger. What for us is an attempt to get to the bottom of things and express the inexpressible becomes for the Jew a pretext for verbal juggleries. His only talent is for masticating ideas so as to disguise his thought. He has observed that the Aryan mind is stupid to the point of accepting anything in matters of religion as soon as the idea of God is recognized. With the Aryan, the belief in the beyond often takes a quite childish form, but this belief does represent an effort towards a deepening of things. The man who doesn't believe in the beyond has no understanding of religion. The great trick of Jewry was to insinuate itself fraudulently amongst the religions with a religion like Judaism, which in reality is not a religion. Simply, the Jew has put a religious camouflage over his racial doctrine. Everything he undertakes is built on this lie. The Jew can take the credit for having corrupted the Greco-Roman world. Previously, words were used to express thoughts. He used words to invent the art of disguising thoughts. Lies are his strength, his weapon in the struggle. The Jew is said to be gifted. His only gift is that of juggling with other people's property and swindling each and every one. Suppose I find by chance a picture that I believe to be a Titian. I tell the owner what I think of it, and I offer him a price. In a similar case, the Jew begins by declaring that the picture is valueless. He buys it for a song and sells it at a profit of 5,000%. To persuade people that a thing which has value has none, and vice versa, that's not a sign of intelligence. They can't even overcome the smallest economic crisis. The Jew has a talent for bringing confusion into the simplest matters, for getting everything muddled up. Thus comes the moment when nobody understands anything more about the question at issue. To tell you something utterly insignificant, the Jew drowns you in a flood of words. You try to analyze what he said, and you realize it's all wind. The Jew makes use of words to stultify his neighbors, and that's why people make them professors. The law of life is, God helps him who helps himself. It's so simple that everybody is convinced of it, and nobody would pay to learn it, but the Jew succeeds in getting himself rewarded for his meaningless glibness. Stop following what he says for a moment, and at once his whole scaffolding collapses. I've always said the Jews are the most diabolic creatures in existence, and at the same time, the stupidest. They can't produce a musician or a thinker. No art, nothing, less than nothing. They're liars, forgers, crooks. They owe their success only to the stupidity of their victims. If the Jew weren't kept presentable by the Aryan, he'd be so dirty he couldn't open his eyes. We can live without the Jews, but they couldn't live without us. When the Europeans realize that, they'll all become simultaneously aware of the solidarity that binds them together. The Jew prevents this solidarity. He owes his livelihood to the fact that this solidarity does not exist.
Wow.
Wow. You talk about wisdom. I think he tells it like it is, and he was exposed to those people when he was very young and in Vienna and kind of down and out and barely surviving. So his perception of them is what he learned at a young age, and he got wise in a hurry. And when he says this, Carolyn, the Jews owe their success only to the stupidity of their victims, you know, I think that he would probably be including our compassion is taken advantage of by that bunch. And it's not just that we're stupid, but that we tend to believe and think the better of things.
Well, but that's being stupid, because if we haven't seen enough of what these people do by now, it is stupidity.
It leaves us open to exploitation. And where he wraps that up there, that this is right on the money as to what's going on in all the predominantly Aryan or white nations of the world today. When he says the Jew prevents this solidarity, the solidarity is what binds people together, he owes his livelihood to the fact that this solidarity does not exist. Now, that is why the Jew pushes diversity as a real blessing, and then this multiculturalism as beneficial to the nation, because a racially unified people scares the hell out of these exploitive, extortionist Jews. And he hit the nail right on the head there.
Well, but Ray, you know, we should be able to see through that, you know. Mm-hmm. And certainly we could see through it if it wasn't for the government and media control. Because
right.
The message that everybody's getting all the time is one thing. And it's really a matter of power and fitting in. And people would see through it all, except that they don't want to be outcast. They don't want to be, you know, they don't want to suffer any kind of consequences. They don't even want to lose a single friend. Mm-hmm. They don't even want to have people disapprove of what they're saying. They don't want anything. So that's kind of a cowardliness, and it's a stupidity. Because we don't have to believe these things, but mm-hmm. it's just going along with the crowd. But he says, I like this part too, because, I think it's very important. Because he says that once we become aware, or, you know, mm-hmm. simultaneously aware that their solidarity binds them together, and our solidarity could bind us together, mm-hmm. but that they can't live without us, but we can live without them, that's what it takes. And this has been, he was saying this back then. We haven't advanced any. People are still saying this now, and a whole lot of people can't even say this now.
Mm-hmm.
But many do, and it's not any different from this. This is the whole secret to it.
Well, what he's describing there is a parasitic relationship when he says we can live without them, but they can't live without us. And then when he says the Jew has put a religious camouflage over his racial doctrine, what he is talking about is Jewish supremacism. That term that I've read in a few of the books lately, but everything he undertakes is built on this lie about he's a religious person and people persecute him because of his religious views, which nothing could be further from the truth. Nobody.
He was one of the first people probably to say that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't the first person to say it, mm-hmm. or the first even well-known person to say it,
mm-hmm.
but he got that real clear, that they were trying
yes.
to pretend to be a religion when they were a race, and people still are not getting that, and
that's
don't
right.
don't want other people to get
mm-hmm.
it. So it's purposefully dissembling going on there, that
yes.
they're talking about how they're a religion, and you have to respect everybody's religion, and so on.
Oh yeah, and when you like today, like you brought up just a little bit ago, when our institutions are in the hands of those enemies, the media, the government, and all, then the average Joe, being the sheep that the masses are, they follow. One, because they generally trust leaders. Two, because You know, it's better to get along and to go along, go along to get along, and the road less traveled. It's easier to go like the masses go rather than to put your foot down and say, hey, you know what, this is a cancer upon our nation. If we don't get rid of it, we're all going to die. So
that's right. But, we don't have any excuse. I don't think we have any excuse whatsoever to be so cowardly and to allow this to go on like death.
I will agree with that, Carolyn. But, you know, when people like you or other folks with a radio show or write books or try to pass the word to wake people up, so to speak, the alarm bells are going off on the Titanic and the passengers just say ho-hum and go back to sleep, that gets frustrating and things like this, but they do that. They have been taught to regard people like you, people like me, others that are trying to get the word out as dangerous radicals that they shouldn't listen to.
Oh, well, you know. Don't they have a brain? I just cannot make excuses.
Right.
And here's the thing. You notice that Hitler doesn't distinguish good Jews and bad Jews.
That's right.
And a
good
lot
point.
Of things with these people, the reason there's all kinds of people who are doing what you're saying, trying to get the word out, but they do distinguish good Jews and bad Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the most serious problems because we continue to have these Jews hanging around. And there's some that almost everybody thinks highly of, and they're not like the horrible ones, but they still believe in that Jews have to be allowed to be in our countries and because they want to be here. And they support Israel, and they do all kinds of things, but they might do a few things. They might be critical of a few things. They might be critical of the Holocaust a little bit. All a Jew has to do is to say, well, I don't believe in the entire Holocaust the way it is. And then everybody embraces him and thinks that they're just wonderful and thinks that it's going to help so much. Whereas then when you listen to the rest of what they say, it doesn't help at all.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to that points to exactly what he was saying about their glibness and their use of words to cloud the issue and to bury the real points. And that's exactly what he was talking about, what you're mentioning right there.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to solve this problem here. We got to get back to what Hitler is saying. But this was good. I think, he put it all down there exactly the way it is. Oh, I like that. God helps him who helps himself.
Yes.
Because that sounds like such a trite saying. Mm-hmm. But the way I see the meaning of this, I'm sure that he saw it that way too, or even, in a higher, little bit higher level, that the law of life is that if you want something, you have to start out after it. You have to put some steps, you have to take some steps. You have to put forth some energy. Even if you just are thinking about it and wanting it and knowing that you want it, and then you do a few things about it, that puts it into motion. And then the universe brings to you more and more and more to fill that out. That's the way the universal laws work when we talk about this kind of thing. I'm not talking about universal in the way of international. but it works for everybody. Anyway, and this is what's behind the very truth that God helps those who help themselves, even if you don't think about it as a God in that narrower sense that so many people do, like God's going to make a decision to help me or something, but that it just works that way. You have to start something in motion. You have to start taking steps towards something, and then it will start to fill in on its own.
Well, I think that's an excellent observation, Carolyn, because when I read that God helps him who helps himself, contrast that with this one, the meek shall inherit the earth. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they're diametrically opposed to one another. Anyway.
Yeah, we don't know what the meek means. I never understood
mm-hmm.
some of those things either.
Oh, yeah, right.
Let's go ahead with it.
Okay. Night of 10th and 11th November 1941. The civil service is the refuge of mediocre talents, for the state does not apply the criterion of superiority in the recruitment and use of its personnel. The party must take care not to imitate the state. Indeed, it should follow the opposite path. We don't want any kind of status in the party similar to the status of officials. Nobody in the party may have an automatic right to promotion. Nobody may be able to say, now it's my turn. Priority for talent, that's the only rule I know. By sticking to these principles, the party will always have supremacy over the state, for it will have the most active and resolute men at its head. Amongst our decorations, there are three that really have value: Mother's Cross, Service Decoration, and Wounds Badge. At the top of them, the Mother's Cross in gold. It's the finest of the lot. It's given without regard for social position, to the peasant's wife or the minister's wife. With all the other decorations, even if as a rule they're awarded on good evidence, there are cases of favoritism. During the First World War, I didn't wear my Iron Cross first class because I saw how it was awarded. We had in my regiment a Jew named Gutmann who was the most terrible coward. He had the Iron Cross first class. It was revolting. I didn't decide to wear my decoration until after I returned from the front, when I saw how the Reds were behaving to soldiers. Then I wore it in defiance. In the Army, this question used to be asked: can one bestow on a subordinate a decoration that his military superior does not possess? We do that more easily nowadays than it was done during the First World War, but it's difficult to behave fairly in this matter. One can be a courageous soldier and have no gift for command. One can reward courage by a Knight's Cross without implying a subsequent promotion to a higher rank. Moreover, the man must have favorable circumstances if his courage is to reveal itself. Command, on the other hand, is a matter of predisposition and competence. A good commander can earn only the oak leaves. What is decisive for him is to rise in rank. A fighter pilot receives the swords and diamonds. The commander of the air fleet neither has them nor can earn them. The Knight's Cross ought to carry a pension with it, against the event of the holders no longer being able to earn his living. It's the nation's duty, similarly, to ensure that the wife and children of a soldier who has distinguished himself do not find themselves in need. One could solve this problem by awarding the Knight's Cross posthumously. To escape any resulting depreciation, I shall create an order of the party, which will not be awarded except in altogether exceptional cases. Thus, all other decorations will be eclipsed. The state can grant whatever it likes. Our decoration will be the finest in the world, not only in its form, but also because of the prestige that will be attached to it. The organization of the order of the party will comprise a council and a court, which will be entirely independent of one another and both placed under the immediate authority of the Führer. Thus, this distinction will never be awarded to persons undeserving of it. There are cases in which one no longer knows how to reward a leader who has rendered outstanding services. The exploits of 200 holders of the Knight's Cross are nothing compared to the services of a man like Tote. In the party, the tradition should therefore be established of awarding distinction only with the utmost parsimony. The best way of achieving that object is to associate such an award with the granting of a pension. The party's insignia in gold ought to be superior to any distinction granted by the state. The party distinctions cannot be awarded to a stranger. When I see a man wearing the blood order, I know that here is somebody who has paid with his own person wounds or years of imprisonment.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about that? I think this is really interesting, and I think there's not so much to say about it because it speaks for itself. But
you know what, that to me, Carolyn, that's the words of a veteran. That's the word of a soldier that's been in the front lines.
Mm-hmm. And knows how it works, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because it's impossible, really, to get awards and decorations to be actually perfectly fit the situation and not be totally fair. because there's too many people handing them out, different people for different reasons, and they might like this person and not like some other person, and
sure,
lots of problems take place. But he's saying that in the party, we don't have to have those kind of problems, and he wants the order of the party, is that what he called
mm-hmm.
it, to be really special. And when I first read this, and he said that the three that really had value were the Mother's Cross, the Service Decoration, the Wounds Badge, I was shocked at first because I thought the Wounds Badge, because that's just handed out to anybody who gets any kind of a wound. I remember reading Willie Wenger in his story about his time in the Battle of Berlin, that he got a shot at something that went into his hand, and after he got it treated at the local place where, you know, where he could go, this is during wartime, he said they handed me my wounds badge. It wasn't anything very that mm-hmm. anybody took a big time on, but what Hitler is saying is that, you know, it means something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody who's wounded gets that wounds badge, so there's no favoritism in it. It shows mm-hmm. that you were, at least you were there and you got wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think he was alluding to the very common sense fact that that a lot of those awards had been distributed kind of indiscriminately and overly done, and it cheapens the value of such an award, and he could see that, you know, and it especially ticked him off about that Jew in his own outfit with the iron, you know, the Iron Cross,
yeah,
first class. And like I say, all of that he said right there is a product of his military life, being a soldier in the front lines.
And I like that he says that soldiers who really did distinguish themselves, mm-hmm. That their families should be taken care of. And it's just,
that's right,
a shame to not do that.
Yeah, and apparently that award was not given if the soldier had died, because he said one of the ways to correct this would be to award this Knight's Cross posthumously, mm-hmm. to make sure that that soldier's wife and family were taken care of to an extent. So, yeah, it's a very compassionate thing.
Yeah, and there he is once again. He's covering everything. He doesn't let anything pass by his attention. So, all right, well, I think we're gonna end the program now, Ray, right?
Okay, yeah, that's
and
fine.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, this is Carolyn Yeager and Ray Goodwin with Hitler's Table Talk on June 5th, 2014, and we will be back next week with more good stuff. Please join us then.
Good night.